Today's topic is disenchantment, the next factor in the 12-fold liberative dependent origination. And I introduced the concept of disenchantment near the beginning of the retreat, where I quoted the Buddha talking about becoming disenchanted with suffering. And perhaps by now, some of you are starting to get disenchanted with some of your suffering. And that could be, it could be, depending how you understand disenchantment, it could be very wise, it could be a wonderful thing. Starting with yesterday's factor, the knowledge and vision of things as they are, the whole path of transcendent dependent origination has picked up the factor of wisdom. Now wisdom is becoming more important, as and with seeing things as they are, that is a wise thing to do. But now the next step, disenchantment, is even more so the working of wisdom, a faculty of mind which is a beautiful thing, a wonderful thing, that can be engaged and supportive. And maybe it helps to see it as a factor of wisdom, because on first impressions, the topic of disenchantment can seem somewhat discouraging. It's excuse me. I think of a similar word to disenchantment is the word disillusioned. And then in particular, usually people say the word, when they say they're disillusioned, it usually is associated with being really disappointed and, like, you know, let down, and you know, it's kind of like a bummer to be disillusioned. But literally, it means that you've been freed of your illusions. Shouldn't that make you happy? I was deluded. I was living in my illusions of things, and now I'm becoming disillusioned. So maybe it doesn't work so strongly with the word disillusionment, but maybe it works better with disenchantment. To no longer be enchanted, to no longer be under the spell of the things that we are under the spell of. No longer caught. So maybe disenchantment could be also be called discaughtness. Discaughtenment. I was criticized recently for making up too many English words. I think that's part of the wonderfulness of the English language. We're allowed to. Discaughtenment. So to become disenchanted, no longer be caught in the web of enchantment. And you know, there's people in our society who are paid a lot of money to try to get us enchanted, be caught under the spell of what certain consumer products will do for you. Paper clips advertised with beautiful half-naked people. If you could have this paperclip and certainly things will go a lot better for you. I won't tell you the brand in case you want to keep you here at the retreat. So, you know, it's in, so this is now we're at the wisdom factor. And I think it's helpful to think of it that way so that it becomes an empowerment rather than a discouragement. Disenchantment shouldn't be the same thing as discouragement. So really, the movement of this transcendental dependent liberation is a movement forward, a movement upward, or movement to maturity, to growth. And so there's a rightness to it. Even though it might be a little bit disorienting to be disenchanted by things that you've lived your life with for a long time, there might be grief involved. But the you know, it's really a movement forward. And it follows, at least in this chain of transcendent origination, it follows these wonderful qualities. Qualities of states of mind, of delight and joy and tranquility and happiness and concentration. Kind of builds on those. But I like this that we get now to disenchantment, because we don't have to no longer see it as having to kind of one following the other. We don't see any of them as following the other, just they come in their own wave and time. But disenchantment can happen in any time, in any phase of a person's life. And, you know, some people come to Buddhist practice because they've gotten disenchanted. They, you know, how they were living no longer works. Things that they were thought were so important to base their lives on, they're no longer interested in basing their life on that. Then sometimes people come to Buddhism and they still feel like they have to base their life on something, so they base it on Buddhism. And then it takes a few years before you get disenchanted with Buddhism. But that is the idea. You know, a certain kind of... You know, if you're enchanted by Buddhism, sooner or later, you're supposed to get disenchanted. You have to. Some people then get disappointed by it, because they kind of mix up disenchantment and disappointment. And then if we get disappointed, then it feels like we just get deflated, we kind of lose our energy, we kind of just want to give up. But disenchantment is not disappointment. And at any point in their lives, as we grow up, and you don't have to even practice Buddhism to have wisdom operating, and to sooner or later realize that something that we've been basing our life on, some values, some beliefs, some something, no longer grabs us, no longer seems to have the kind of promise it once had. And so then we outgrow things. And certainly there are things that you were enchanted by when you were in high school that don't enchant you anymore. And you don't even notice, you know, the very slow process of becoming, you know, losing that enchantment that, oh, that's so important. And there are some things now that you probably are thoroughly disenchanted by. Completely, you know, if someone offered you certain things, no way. Like, you know, someone came along and said, I have a job for you. This is a great job. You're going to be really rich. Make a lot of money. move big things in the world. And I'm going to make you a stockbroker on Wall Street. And you get to work 60 hours a week, tracking ups and downs of the stock market really closely and yelling out your quotes. And when you're not working, you'll be studying the web all your waking hours to kind of really research, you know, the stocks and the companies, and it'll be great. And you won't have time for friends, but you'll be making a lot of money. And oh, your food, you know, we order McDonald's mostly just to, we don't have time for anything else, but but the money is good. So we come along and offer you this wonderful high-paying job. My guess is that I'd have a hard time enchanting any of you with that kind of life. Like, you know, no way. It just doesn't, you know, doesn't enchant you. You're completely disenchanted with a life based on that. And I kind of like to think that's wisdom. You know better. You know there's better things. So we get disenchanted with things. So we get disenchanted with the pursuit of money, perhaps, for its own sake. We get disenchanted with the pursuit of status. We get disenchanted with the pursuit of pleasure. Nothing wrong with pleasure. But to pursue that at the cost of everything else, some people think that they only have a successful life if they have wonderfully pleasant experiences. Become disenchanted with having, I don't know, okay, you can go through the list of things that, you know, they no longer pull us or drive us or, you know, whatever they promise they give is not, doesn't really live up to what we want to be about anymore. For meditators, sometimes it's becoming disenchanted with meditation states. Seems odd, right? You think that it's all about meditation states, having certain experiences. We become disenchanted with states, experiences. Some people will have experiences galore, and it takes a long time before they realize enough of this. I mean, this is not, maybe not so helpful just to have experiences. Disenchanted with what other people think of you. That was an important part of my process, was I was so neurotically, compulsively concerned with other people thought of me and whether people liked me or not. And I came eventually to realize it was kind of overrated what people think about you. So I became disenchanted with the whole idea that I had to kind of arrange the universe so that everyone liked me. Or that I should be concerned what other people think about me. I mean, a little bit it's okay, a little bit it's healthy, actually. It's appropriate to have some concern what other people think about you, but to have our happiness dependent on it, to have our whole sense of self and who we are dependent on what other people think, it can be very quite beautiful, quite wonderful, freeing to become disenchanted with concerns about what other people think. Let them think what they want. Sometimes it's unfortunate if they have power over us, authority over us, to make decisions. But sometimes they don't. And sitting on the retreat with fellow retreatants, doesn't matter what the other retreatants think about you. Because you shift in your seat too often. You have black socks. The image I have for becoming disenchanted, and I'm sure other images, other ways, other approaches work, but in my mind the image of it is that of a powerful snake that just is growing and getting bigger, and so it sheds its skin. So as we kind of become freer, we become maybe bigger or more confident or more present, or and as we do that we can shed these old skins we don't need anymore, and eventually we can shed the skin of needing to be anything for anybody, including for ourselves. You're welcome to be someone, but to need to be someone, to be preoccupied. To become disenchanted with clinging. To become disenchanted with resistance. Disenchanted with avoidance. Disenchanted with desire. One of the small turning points I had with desire was when I was younger, I used to go to bookstores, used bookstores, or any bookstores, and I noticed after a while that I left the bookstores tireder than when I went in. So I got curious why that was, and I discovered that it's because when I went into bookstores, I wanted most of the titles. So I'd go, I want that, I want that, I want that. I didn't have any money, but I want that. And that movement of desire, of wanting this, wanting that, and do it so compulsively, so like, you know, so much of it. There's one thing, you know, go in, look around, and they have 10,000 books, and you kind of choose one. I think someday I'd like to have that one. That's probably pretty relaxing, but, you know, when you go every shelf, like, I want that, that. And so... that's what exhausted me. And to see the consequence of tiredness and exhaustion from this incessant desire was one of the things that started me in the path of becoming disenchanted with desire. It wasn't worth it. It wasn't, you know, the cost was so great. Some people get disenchanted with resentment when they feel the cost of the resentment. Wow. That louse, he hasn't thought about me for probably 30 years. My resentment is not harming him. Guess who it harms? So you feel, wow, it's a certain kind of, this resentment is not living up to its promise. And so then, you know, I'm only harming myself, not that louse. And so then kind of, I've known people, that's when they began to shed their resentment. It's when they realized the cost. So this is one of the nice things about this kind of practice, retreat practice, is that you get to kind of live in your life here in a way that's kind of, in a certain kind of way, undistracted from your life. There's not a lot of interruptions from the normal ways in which your mind operates to operate and see it over and over and over again. And one of the important ways of wisdom, how wisdom is developed, is through repetition, through familiarity. And so to see your mind do the same thing over and over and over again, it's like looking at the Grand Canyon. It's like Half Dome at Yosemite. Wow, isn't that amazing? It's kind of awesome that your mind has this capacity. Over and over again. So then after a while, it comes, oh, enough of this. Or, this is not living up to any of the promise it had. And in fact, not only that, but it takes me away from myself. It takes away from an intimacy or from a growth or from a richness or from a beautiful simplicity of being, just being here in a live way. I've spent a lot of time on retreat planning all kinds. And sometimes the planning finally abated when I became so familiar with it that I got just tired of it. Enough. You know, I thought it was actually, I could feel the way it took me away from myself. It was a disconnect with a certain kind of rich aliveness and presence here. Be here in a simple way, just breathing, felt more satisfying than planning. So I see disenchantment as a consequence of wisdom, of understanding. And understanding that some ways of being are preferable to other ways. But wisdom comes from within. Wisdom means that you see that it's not so preferable anymore. Something's not living up to its promise that you had before. The promise of worry. Probably never wondered, you never kind of probably considered, if you're a worrier and spend a lot of time worrying, what's the promise of worry? What's the bait? What's the promise that worrying is kind of dangling in front of you? If you can just worry enough, it'll all work out. It'll all be solved. If you just worry enough, then people know you care, and it's important people know that you care. What's the promise that your worry has for you? What's the bait? What is the hook that convinces you that it's your system? It's important to worry. Is there any real promise? Is there any real honest value to worrying? So becoming disenchanted. So I think of it as an act of wisdom that comes in its own time. It comes in, comes in its own way. And you're under no obligation to get disenchanted. And sometimes, because disenchantment is kind of like a heavy word, maybe, and, you know, it's kind of like one of those words in Buddhism that can be kind of a drag. What other kind of dragging words are there? Like, let go. Just let go. Jesus. You know, then you can do it with letting go, or more dramatically, renounce. Be good. Have lots of loving kindness. Buddhists are supposed to be kind people. Come to Buddha Center, you better act up, better behave. It's kind of a drag, all these things, right? If it's taken on the wrong way, like you're supposed to. Something's supposed to happen. You're supposed to live up to something. There's standards that are offered, and ideals that are offered. There's so. It just happens to be that I've been highly authorized Buddhist teacher. Which it's good to get disenchanted by. But sometimes it's good to really kind of take the seat, the full seat, my full authority. So I have authorized to be a Vipassana teacher. Pretty good. I'm authorized to be a Zen teacher. Watch out. I have a PhD in Buddhism. So that's a lot. So I'm going to take my full stature of authority to tell you something that I think is really important. And that is that Buddhism obligates you to nothing. Buddhism is not a system or a religion that says you have to be a Buddhist, you have to do the Buddhist path, you have to attain something, you have to. There's no obligation whatsoever. You're kind of the view of Buddhism, at least the view of the Buddha, is really, I see it as one where people are given their freedom and their profound respect, their autonomy, their choice. There's no one who's telling you that you have to do something. And I see it as, I kind of like to see it as a very respectful, a lot of respect for each person, for who they are and how they are and how you are and your life and you're finding your way. And then Buddhism comes along and it has something to offer. And if it seems to fit for you, or interest for you, or meaningful for you, then, you know, you can welcome to try it on and make it work for yourself. And those teachings that work, great. Those teachings that don't work for you, it's fine. I've seen people who, more often among Catholics than others, that they have this idea that if they're going to be involved in Buddhism, they have to, like, take it all on. They have to, like, the tenets, the beliefs, they have to kind of leave it all. Take it or leave it, whatever you want. To give you an example of a wonderful way of take it or leave it, in places like Thailand and Burma, I don't know about Burma, but in Thailand, sometimes people, when they take the precepts, they get to choose how many they take. Isn't that nice? You know, I think I could commit to the first four. You know, or I could commit to the last four. You know, maybe the person might be a fisherman. You know, they're a fisherman or something, and that's their whole livelihood, and taking care of their families is based on fishing. But they want to somehow, so they go to the temple, and so they don't take the first precept, but they take the other four. Isn't that kind of, I think that's great, isn't it? No obligation. Hopefully they see it as useful to take on. It's useful for them. It supports them. It makes them a better person. Maybe, I think usually the idea is that eventually I'll do the others, but I'm not ready now. As opposed to like a puritanical idea, like you better do the five precepts. So, I like to think of Buddhism as having a lot of respect for each person. Each person can find their own way and what's beneficial for them. And that one of the ways that we can do this is to really get to know ourselves well, really connect to ourselves deeply. And that kind of is in harmony with the idea of mindfulness, of practice, and really coming here, coming close in. Not spending time in fantasy, not spending time in the past and the future. Not because it's bad to do that necessarily, and you're a wrong person because you're doing that, but because if you really want to kind of respect yourself in a deep way and find out what's true for yourself and what works for you, you really want the information of staying close here. What's going on here? Get to know yourself. Learning about what trips you up, learning about the kind of efforts you make in your life or in practice that makes you suffer or makes you tight or stressed. Learn what efforts make you can do that makes you feel nourished, supported, or helped, or alive, connected. You know, that only you can answer those questions. Only you can find that out. There's no, like, no one can tell you that what it is like for you, the path that you need to take exactly. What old beliefs do you carry with you that you no longer need? So you have to first learn what those beliefs are. So out of this respect, deep respect for ourselves maybe, or and the valuing of our lives, valuing of our well-being, to care for ourselves. We can come to a place sometimes where we start seeing more clearly what's going on, seeing things as they are, seeing that some things don't live up to their promise, seeing some things, I see that we've gotten enchanted in the spell of some things. We believe something that's not necessary to believe. We invest a lot of importance in something. We invest a lot of importance you can go through a list, but in struggle, a lot of importance in being right, a lot of importance in hiding so no one knows what's really happening. Invest a lot of importance in trying to please someone, or trying to make ourselves safe. So the alternative to, I was wondering, thinking today about what is the alternative to disenchantment? And I don't know if it's the best choice as an alternative, but I thought of the word aspiration. I like the word aspiration, partly because the word is connected to the word breath, breathing in Latin, like respiration. And aspiration is a kind of a something that we're motivated by, that we hope for, that we like an intention. But I think of it, because it's connected to the breathing, it's kind of like the heartfelt aspiration, the heartfelt, the movement towards something really good and beneficial. And I like thinking of aspiration as an alternative to disenchantment, because I think it's possible to hear talks on disenchantment, and it kind of goes along with this kind of simplistic idea that, you're supposed to let go of all desire. Like, you're not supposed to have any desires. But there is aspiration, and in this path of liberative dependent origination, there can be the aspiration for freedom, the aspiration for liberation, the aspiration not to be, to be no longer caught, the aspiration to not be limited anymore, to not be disconnected anymore, not be weighed down anymore, the aspiration not to be caught inside the walls of our own defensiveness. There was a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon from many years ago of Calvin out in the snow building a fort. He's building a fort with high walls. Small little fort, but enough for him to be inside of. So he's building with high walls. Surrounded himself with walls. Walls were high enough then that then he was stuck inside. The cartoon boxes, him yelling, "Help!" So the aspiration not to have walls. The aspiration to have a heart that's unburdened, that's clean, the aspiration to have a mind which is like a clear window, clean window that you don't even know there's glass because it's so clean, a mind that's so free and that the awareness is so, that kind of it's there, but it's just so free, open. So disenchantment can be discouraging. There can be grief, there can be sadness, there can be, some sense of discouragement when we've kind of invested something for so long. And then we have to realize this is not working anymore, so we want to give it up. And then we have nothing to replace it with. But I think that if, again, the aspiration part of come back, I think Andrea mentioned this too, that there's a natural intuition or feeling or sense of potential of freedom. Or, if you don't like that kind of word, we use that word so often in Buddhism that it loses its value. I much like the feeling of the heart at home in itself. I think of home as a place where you can just kind of be yourself. You're safe, you can be yourself, you can walk around in your pajamas or your underwear even, and no one cares. You're comfortable with bad hair day. You're at home, it's okay, you're at home. But have your heart at home in itself. And finally, the the need for disenchantment, or the possibility of disenchantment, is there because we were enchanted to begin with. And enchantment is an activity of the mind. It's a samkara, it's a mental formation. The mind is working. Mind is in doing something, and so it's spinning, it's agitated, even though it might be very mild. We think something's important, we're involved in something, we're trying to get something to happen, we're hoping for something, we're, you know, something we want, something we believe in. The mind is subtly, maybe not so subtly, working, doing. And so the other side of disenchantment is those things, that those activities of mind quiet down. And so there's this movement of transcendent dependent origination is a kind of a movement of the unnecessary activity of the mind quieting down, getting stiller. The unnecessary movements, agitation, quiet down. And we're moving to things becoming quieter, stiller. And so the next step in dependent origination is dispassion. The word is viraga, which dispassion is a fine translation of viraga. It works fairly well. But the word raga has a dual meaning in Sanskrit and Pali. It means, can mean passion, but it also means the dye with which you color a cloth. And so viraga also means a fading of the dye. And so this fading of so the other side of disenchantment is the beginning of fading away, stilling of the colored lenses in which we see our lives, the colored, the way the mind is colored by emotions and desires and passions and aversions. So this movement towards a stillness, a stilling, peacefulness, here, that kind of birthright we have. Be at peace with just being alive, just being here.